Okay, so we should get going. So this is second last week of lectures, so there's some lectures and tutorials next week, but that will be the end of the teaching. I will say next week something about the examinable material on the theory side. So just to let you know what sorts of things I expect you to be able to do when it comes to exam. So today I want to talk about higher order logic programming. So what's that? So we already saw that we could do certain things which we called metaprogramming, but here we're interested in doing higher order things which are like, if you've, for those of you who've looked at Haskell, higher order functional programming. So in higher order functional programming, you can pass around functions as arguments. So here we've been basing what we're doing on the syntax of first order logic. In first order logic, quantifiers range over individuals. So we have predicates, but we can't quantify over predicates, and we can't quantify over function symbols. So let's see what happens here. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at an extended logic, a logic that goes beyond first-order logic, and then think, how can we still do logic programming? So there's a very nice answer to this. We saw in the first-order case, we took a restricted subset, the definite clauses. And here again, there's a subset of all of first-order logic for which this works, but it is a very interesting area to look at, and it has very nice features which I think are interesting in their own right. So having said what this subset is, then we'll be interested in seeing what do we need to do logic programming in this context. And we're going to have to extend the notion of search to see what to do with some of the extra things that we're going to deal with here. Okay, so this is what we've been looking at lots of times so far. So pure prolog is a subset of the language for which this definite clause setting works. So we're ignoring arithmetic things like is, and we're ignoring meta predicates like var and clause and so on. And we're also ignoring verb. Okay, so that's the subset that we're interested in here, is pure prolog. So in definite clauses, then we have this shape that you know from prolog clauses with a head, maybe a head on its own unit clause, or a head which follows from some number of atomic things. And we read that as the things in the body conjoined together imply a head. That's the logical reading of what's going on. And now we're searching for a derivation, and we're using this back chain rule. So we can find proofs if they exist. And we have a search procedure. There are various search procedures, but we have in particular the prolog search procedure. So this is declarative. So this notion of declarative has two slightly different meanings. So what we're saying here, in which we say we can read the program as a set of logical statements, we can read the query as, does this statement follow logically? Is there an instantiation for the variables such that the query follows logically from the statement in the program? So we've turned it into a question of deduction. Can we deduce something? So languages, particularly like Haskell, are called declarative. It's a slightly different sense of declarative, but it really means we've got a logical reading of the statements in front of us. In case of functional programs, we've got a definition of a function, and then we're simply interested in knowing what things evaluating to what. And that's a statement about the functions, not a statement about the order in which the computation happens. So we can think about this more abstract understanding of what's going on there. And some of you will be have done programming language semantics, so that's what's going on in this, usually given in this form. For functional languages, there's logic programming languages have their own reading of what's going on, and that's what we've seen in the semantics. So languages like Haskell, Lisp, going back a long way, ML, which you may also have seen. So in each of these languages, we have higher order things going on. So we have function like plus, which pertains to integers, say. So integers are individuals. But now we can have functions which take plus itself as an argument and do something with it. We can compose plus with something else and get other functions. So these are the higher order aspects of these programming languages. And it'd be nice to see what you can do in a logic programming context to capture some of these sorts of. So
the prolog is the first order case. There are strange things you can do inside the first order case, but not by respecting this declaration.
declarative meaning. So I do want to stress a difference here between some of the things we've seen so far. So we looked at meta-reasoning, so the idea that we could take prologue as reasoning about prologue, the idea you can look at clause and so on, and you can do meta-interpreters, for example. So this is a different notion. That is a different notion. So that's a notion which says, yes, we can represent prologue inside prologue. In the same way, you can actually represent Lisp inside Lisp. It's an untyped language. It's quite easy to do that. People write Lisp interpreters in Lisp for various reasons. So you write this prologue interpreter in prologue. So this is not higher order as it stands. Because in this case, because when you're working there, you're using this use mention distinction, you're really operating directly in the syntax. Okay, so why is first order logic called first order? Because the quantifiers, if it all exists, quantify over individuals. So when we looked at the models had a domain, and the objects we're quantifying over are the objects in the domain. That's the reading of what's happening here. Okay, so what would be a richer thing to do? Well, one thing I think is, suppose we wanted to quantify over predicates. And this is a very natural thing to do. You can think, for example, here of this is the notion of induction over the natural numbers. So sometimes there's different ways of writing this down. But we have a general principle that says if we know that we have some property P, and we say, well, if and this is almost the way you see it written down in classes here. So if you know that P equals 0, and if you know that for any x, if P equals of x, then P equals of successor here is x plus 1. I'll just call it s of x. Then you can conclude that actually for every natural number. So this is an inference, well, this is an inference rule. And it can correspond to an axiom which you can write up there, which says, well, whatever P is, and now this quantifier is a second order, whatever P is, if P of 0 and it's the case that this holds, then it should be the case that this holds. So these two go together. I'm turning this inference rule into a statement now. These are distinct objects, but they correspond rather closely. And that's a statement you've got up there using the more standard implication symbol. And that's a statement that makes very good sense in second order logic. Second order because we're quantifying over the predicates. And that's the induction principle for natural numbers. Natural numbers is a data type given by saying zero is there and successor of anything that's there is also there. So that's a statement we could write down. And of course we'd want to use that sort of thing. So this is something that you might think looks rather like a clause in the sense that we have some things that hold, and from the conjunctions of these we get a conclusion that we're interested in. So is this roughly some sort of foreign clause shape? And the answer is, well, roughly, but there's still some problems here. What have we got here? So prologue variables can't appear in the predicate position. So if we're going to deal with universal quantification, if this is a statement, then we would omit this, and then we would have a variable here. So we can't, that's not bona fide first order syntax. One of the sub-goals, so one of the things in the body here, is itself a universally quantified implication. So this is not a symbol that we have. This notion of implication is not something we get in the body here. And this is locally quantified, so we have an explicit quantifier here. And we need to know what the scope of this is. So this is a standard thing if you're doing it's a standard trap in these sorts of proofs, that if you're not careful about the naming of the variable when you start to do induction here, this has to be a fresh variable that doesn't appear anywhere else, you can easily make mistakes in what's going on. So having a local binding, having a locally scoped variable there is important. So what we've got down here beneath the bullet points is something you would like to be able to write. So when does a property hold of an arbitrary term y if it holds of zero, and also if we have a universally quantified statement with the implication. And actually, although that's kind of wishful thinking at this stage, this is actually what we can do in this programming language, which we're going to look at in higher order logic programming. We can make sense of a program clause like that, and we can use it in inference, we can use it in automated, we can use it as a logic programming language, which has a nice search notion associated with it. So that's the main thing I want to say today. So how is this going to work? So this is a language called Lambda Prolog, so there's a whole set of implementations. It's still somewhat experimental, but it has very nice features, and so, as I say, there's a bunch of different implementations of it. So what do we want to do here? So we want to be able to use, to allow ourselves to write these more general-looking statements in something like this sort of syntax. And then we want to have queries which can make use of that particular statement as a step in the derivation and come back automatically and give us solutions, and what's more, give us witnesses for existential quantifiers. So we already know that this doesn't work completely automatically in the way that you might hope it would do in the normal first order case. So these same problems are still here, of course. But let's see what we can do. So in the first case, we've got unification as a key step of what's going on. So unification is going to be a key step still here. And we have to extend the unification because we're now going to have variables of second order, higher order, and so on floating around. So our variables may correspond to individuals or predicates or even to function symbols or predicates of predicates, or third order, fourth order predicates. So this is a very rich language. And then we also want unification as what gives us the witnesses for the existential variables, what gives us witnesses for the variables in the query. So we still want to get answers back for variables here. So we need to extend, and what happens here is we extend the notion of unification to higher order. So I'm not going to explain how that is done. That's a whole area in its own. Somebody called Dale Miller did a lot of this stuff. There are now quite efficient ways of doing it. So we lose certain nice properties, but we don't really have time to go into what's going on there. So what you need to know here is that unification can be made to work at higher order. So let's think of this notion of what's going on at higher order. So an important thing here are these anonymous lambda terms. So it's a notation that you get in lots of languages for describing a function without giving it a name. So this lambda abstraction which happens. So those are the notations in Haskell, Lisp, or ML. So in each case, we're looking at the function here, which we're not going to give it a name, but if we define the function f of x and say it's actually just add 4, then another way of saying this in various of these languages is saying, well, we're going to let f equal, and we could have here Haskell lambda x dot x plus 4. So now f is a symbol on its own, it's a function, and that's its definition. X is input, and the result is x plus 4. So Lisp has its own notation, standard ML has its own notation, and Lambda Prolog has these things as terms. So this Lambda Prolog is closest, I suppose, to Haskell. So when you see variable slash, that's a lambda abstraction, it's a binding that says, consider this term to represent a function whose input could be x or y, but that's a local name for the input, and whose output will be x plus 4, that's the term. So what can we say about these sorts of terms? Well, so one thing is, well, actually, these are local variables. This is a local variable. And this should mean exactly the same thing as lambda y plus 4. We've just changed the local name of the local variable inside the scope. So if we're going to do unification, we want to say here are two functions, are they the same function? Then we want to respect this, so this is called alpha equivalence. So these are just straight queries at the top level of this logic programming language. So in the first case there, we've got two functions. We've got, in fact, these. Sorry, this is a bit low down. We've got the lambda x, x plus 4, lambda y, y plus 4, which I was just talking about there. And now we're saying, are these the same function? And the answer is yes. So this is what's called alpha conversion. So that's just a query, are these the same? So we're saying that the notion of unification is a particular case where you don't do any, there's no variable to instantiate, but we're going to identify two terms which just differ in the names of the local variables. The next one is the notion of application. So we're saying on the left, this is the function lambda x, x plus 4 applied to argument 3. So we're using this, the notation that you inherit from languages like Haskell, where application is just given by a space. So what we've got on the left of the second query there is that function applied to the input 3, and we're querying whether that's the same as 3 plus 4. So again, this is a unification call. There are no variables, but we have to deal with this, notion of applying a function and getting a result. So as terms, these terms are considered equal, the unification algorithm has to recognize that. So the third one is the interesting one. So now f is a variable. So f is a second order variable here. And it's saying, is there some function which applied to 3 gives me back 3 plus 4? And the notion of function is quite restricted here. There's nothing in the background. So no sort of magic that kind of trying to invent functions here. We're just looking for syntax like the syntax we've got above, which functions defined in terms of this notation, lambda x, and then we can use the symbols that we've got on the right. So again here is 3 plus 4, this is the same arithmetic thing we get in prologue. 3 plus 4, if we query 3 plus 4 equals 7, the answer is no. We're not doing arithmetic evaluation here. We are doing this syntactic level. So is there a function, is there a lambda function, which when applied to 3 gives me back the term 3 plus 4? And the answer is, well, the first answer is yes, it's a function which ignores the input and gives me back the result 3 plus 4. So that's lambda x, 3 plus 4. Is there another solution? Yes, it's the function which we saw above. In this case, it's called lambda x1. So it's the function which takes some input value, input parameter x1, and returns x1 plus 4. So you see the unification now has to be smart enough to work out that that's a solution, that's a substitution for f, which solves that unification problem. And there are no more in this space of unifiers. You can see that to try and work this out in generality is going to be rather hard. But it's quite cute you can do this. You can query what is the function which gave me this result. And also you see here that there may be multiple solutions. So it's not a most general. Yes?
Is it the second function down there something in knowledge base?
No.
The function is returns.
No. So all it's doing is making use of So this is not the case that there's anything in the program at this point. There's no knowledge base. Right. Stop. Okay. Too much. So what's happening here is you're saying, so one of the things we can, that are built in, so one of the things that is built in is that lambda x, something involving x, is the same as lambda y. And another thing that's being built in is if you have a lambda x, f and the x appears in it, and you apply it to some term, then that should be the same as what we get f with that term. So these are the things that are built in, and that's all. And you can see in the second one down there, you've now got f equals lambda x1, what do you call it, x1 plus 4. And now we say, okay, if we take this and we apply it to 3, then just using this information here, just using the fact that so if f is this, then f of 3 is going to be 3 plus 4. So that's using this up here. So you have to reverse this procedure that says
So you have to look and see, could this be the result of using one of these rules? This rule.
Okay, so let's think how we extend the language here to build this. So in this case, we need to assign types, so because we need to know which objects are individuals and which things are function types and so on. So we're going to assign types, so there'll be some declaration of types. It's a syntax that will appear. And if you've done work in Haskell, you'll be aware of this sort of thing going on. We add implications directly to the language, so the commas are still corresponding to conjunctions, the prologue, colon hyphen is going to correspond to backwards implication, but we add a primitive symbol, this implication symbol, and we just read this as logical implication. And we have these lambda terms, so term language is not just the constants and function symbols applied to terms. We are also allowed to do this lambda application, we get these lambda terms, these anonymous function terms. And we also add universal quantification, an explicit universal quantification. And this is it, okay, so that's it. So there's still going to be a definite clause-like shape to these things. It's a little bit more complicated than this, it's a bit more complicated than this, but if you look up the Lambda Prolog homepage, there's a homepage for this and it will explain in lots of detail if you're interested. Okay, so what does this look like? So this is the universal quantification. So there's a slightly strange thing that happens here, which is that which makes good sense if you think about it. So universal quantification usually involves this local binding. So what's the scope of the quantifier? Throwing my chalk out. Right, so instead of writing for all x and then some statement involving x, the idea here is you're going to split this up into two bits. So this here says x is a local variable and here's its scope. So we've already got lambda abstraction here, so we can write x lambda. And now we've got something involving x here. So this is a term. And now we just have this is a built-in constant, and it says that the intended meaning here is that this statement says for every x, this holds. So we've split, if you like, the universal property away from the binding. So in the normal case here, we know the scope of the x is a local variable. We've got a binding construct, so we just use that and the constant pi, which just means it's always the case. So what we've got at the bottom of this slide is a version of something that says, so this really says, the second order thing, every p of 0 implies p of 0. True statement, however you look at it. And you can put that in as a query at the top level and it'll say yes, that's okay. So this is just a slightly off-putting piece of syntax at first, but it's perfectly natural if you think we're trying to deal with the binding in one go, and then this pi is universal. So how do we make sense of this? So there are two statements which both succeed. So pi for all pi lambda x, x equals x. Query, is it the case that for every x, x equals x? Answer, yes. And that's different from a goal of top-level goal, x equals x, which actually has existential reading here. Of course, the fact you can get some things out of this because it succeeds without instantiating, but nevertheless, logically, it's distinct. Okay, so what can we say here? So here are some examples. So that's what we saw before. Is it the case that for all x, x equals x? Yes. Is it the case that for all x, for all y, x equals y? Answer, no. So the second one says for all x and for all y, x equals y. Bottom one says, is it the case that now we have a y as a query variable? Is there a function y such that for all x, x equals y? maps the identity function, map x to x. So the unifier here is able to work out, so I haven't decided yet what we do with this pi. So let me say that here. But you can see there's quite subtle things going on here. So basically, if you have a universal quantifier, the idea is to introduce a new constant, which isn't, doesn't appear anywhere. So, and then try and solve the query. And let's see why that's a good idea. So, but that's the right answer, right? So that is a correct answer. And there's no other solution within this framework of alpha and beta. Let me see. Okay, so the second one down here that says, how do you solve a for all query? Let me just do this on the board. The query that starts with the pi, and then some statement involving x. How do you solve this? The idea is introduce a new constant for the x in the body of this, in the body. So we throw away the universal quantification and we solve for, let's call it C17 or something, some constant. So what we're doing is we're introducing something fresh down here and solving that query there. So the claim is that this corresponds completely to the rule for dealing with universal quantification, which says, now let me write it this way, if I can show that some particular property holds of C17, if there are some assumptions, and I can show that if this follows from the assumptions and this constant doesn't appear here, then I can conclude that P holds universally. So this is the logic of it. It says if I can show that something holds for a constant that I don't know anything about, the only way that can happen is that this is actually universally true. So if I can show for a number, and I'm just giving it a name, a number Q, and I don't know anything about Q at all, if I can show that Q has some property, then it must hold for an arbitrary number. It must hold universally. So that's what we're doing here. We're being asked to show something holds universally. You say, OK, invent a new name and show that it holds for that new name. So that's a standard thing to deal with universal quantification, where you can use it inside this logic programming setup. What about implications? So if you have an implication goal, how can I prove P implies Q, given some program now? The idea is just add P to the program. So we're now assuming that we can stick the body in somehow as a program, somehow as a clause in the program. So it's already imposing certain constraints on the exact shape of the program. So here's a completely standard, so there's nothing higher order here, but it's trying to build an implication. So suppose we have a program that says A if B and B if C, and I want to query, does C imply A? And you sit there and say, well, if I have C, then I get B. If I've got B, then I can get A, so that should work. So what we're doing here is to add C locally to the program. So what we're now dealing not with just a stack of goals, but a stack of goals in a particular context. So a stack of context goal pairs. So we're saying, okay, suppose C was in the program, could I deduce A? And the answer is yes. C has a unit clause on its own, the left-hand side of the implication. So the interpreter for this has to work not just with a set of goals, assuming the program is static. It has to work with this combination of what's the current state of the clauses that I'm reasoning about, what are the goals I'm trying to solve in this context. Okay, so here's another example. Suppose you know that A of B and C, and you want to show if C implies B,
what does this search say? It says you're trying to solve something which is an implication. So the implication is C implies B implies A. And so we add C implies B as a clause in the program. And C implies B is just a syntactic sugar for B if C, the other way around. So A, C implies B is the same as the prologue clause which is added just before the last query, B if C. And now that's a standard prologue solution that we get. So we're allowed to add more complex things in here. And we're allowed to add things that have quantifications. So it was quite hard to find the exact shape for which this works, but it was the answer is very pretty when we find it. Okay, so this works fine for implication, and now we can ask queries. So these are top-level queries. There's no program here. Is it the case that A implies B implies A? So that's a top level query, we come back and say yes. Or is it the case that if A implies B implies C, then A implies B implies C? You look at that one and you say yes, okay, after a bit. And that, again, that's one in which you're first of all going to assume the left hand side and then assume the, which is, which we're going to do. Yes, so that the priority of implication says that the left hand side is the A implies B implies C. So that should be, that's not explicit here, it's this left, it's the bracketing to the right. So I just slight word of caution, this is not the truth table view of what's going on. So there's a query for which this doesn't actually work. And there's a good reason, the final one there is one which, if you go through the truth tables, is always true. There are nice reasons, I think, why this should fail here. But let's not go into that. So we've got a notion of implication, of dealing with implication queries. What about the search here? So we've already just looked at D implies G. So if the query is D implies G, you locally add D to the program and keep on going. So you have to keep track of the context. To solve the universal query, pick a new parameter and try and solve the G with the C substituted in for the abstracted variable X. And to solve the atomic case, well, as it's just the same as before, so G doesn't have some compound structure, that you're trying to do this higher order unification with a program clause. But now this is higher order unification, so we already saw some examples of that with the Y. Y as a variable applied to X. Okay, so let me just look at a small example. So this is a piece of history by now. So McCarthy was one of the inventors of artificial intelligence and also one of the contributors right at the very start of Lisp. And here's what we have here is an example of a small piece of reasoning which you would like to be able to deal with using a logic programming approach or any some sort of automated reasoning approach, and which is more tricky than you think. So it's one which doesn't fit into definite clause logic at all naturally, but it does fit into this framework perfectly well. So here's an argument that says something is sterile if all the bugs in it are dead. If a bug is in an object which is heated, then the bug is dead. You have some particular jar, which is this particular jar to be heated, and you want to conclude that it actually is sterile. So if you look at it, at first it kind of looks as though those are maybe all definite clauses. And then you think about, well, actually the second one is the tricky one. If a bug is in an object which is heated, then the bug is dead. So what's going on here? Or the first one, actually. The first one, if something is sterile, if all the bugs in it are dead, so that's a local all, which doesn't fit in very nicely with the setup. So here's a way of describing what's going on. So what we've got here is a whole bunch of type declarations at the top, and then the three clauses, so actually the dead one is fine. So the three clauses, sterile jar if something or other, and dead X if X is heated. In X is in Y in bucket X. So we're using this different syntax which is it's really not materially different. So we're writing in x, y, so normal log in x, y. So what do these notations at the top mean? So type, so here there are two types, two inbuilt types, I of individuals, and O is the type of statement assertions. So sterile is a one place predicate, which takes an argument of type individual and gives you back a statement. In is a two place, and in this current way, in blah blah. So this is an individual, and the whole thing is a statement. So heated is a one place predicate, bug is a one place predicate, dead is a one place predicate. And how do we read this sterile jar? Jar is a variable, so it says for all jars, jar is sterile if. And now we've got explicit universal quantification on the right. So notice if we didn't have that universal quantification treated x as a variable, I would say, is there some bug? Which, if it's in the jar, it's dead. But what we want to say is all the bugs in the jar are dead. So we really need that explicit quantification on the right there. That says for all x, if x is a bug and it's in the jar, then it's dead. And now we've got, what does it mean to what in this program constitutes being dead is being in something which is heated and being a bug. So nothing else can die in this setting. And the particular jar J is heated. So this solves that query. So it's a little exercise to sit down and see how using what we've got so far will allow you using just that program and then these notions here about what universal means and sticking in variables for all. So we want to go sterile J, so that's that's sterile for this particular jar. You could put a query variable there and you would get back the small j because that's the only thing we've got. So you can go through it in a normal prolog style way. But I think that's rather nice because this is exactly what you'd like to write down. Like to write it down like that. That's very close to the statement you had before. The jar is sterile if every bug in the jar is dead. Okay, so let me say just a little bit about nice things you can do with these higher order functions. So if you've used Haskell, you'll immediately think of some of the things we can do here. What's nice here is that we can inherit some of the generality of prolog, being able to write, use predicates in different orders and use it to generate structures and not just compute outputs from inputs. So here's your standard first program. And if you look at a bunch of these things, you'll end up doing programs which are very like this several times. So really what this program is computing is what's called the transitive closure of the parent relation. So one parent, we have a parent, and then you want to come and get chains of parents, finite chains of any length. And then that will be the ancestor relation, will be the two ends of the composition of the parent relation. So we can get less than for a successor, we can get descendant of the main child, parent in the opposite direction. So can we look at this general pattern and describe it using second order ideas? So we're defining one predicate ancestor in terms of another predicate parent. So can we describe the relationship between parent and ancestor in general terms? Well, yes. So this is what we're doing here is we're defining a predicate called transitive, which is meant to be the transitive closure. So the first argument is something of type A to A to O, so that's a binary predicate. So this is polymorphic. A here means I don't care what the type of A is polymorphic, so don't worry about it. So we've got a predicate with two arguments, and we're going to get back a predicate with two arguments. So trans should relate two predicates together. So in the previous case, it was relating parent to ancestor. So how is trans defined? So the transitive version of the predicate relates x to y if that predicate already related x to y. So that's the first clause we had here. So the transitive version ancestor relates x to y if parent relates x to y. And what's the recursive case? Well, the transitive predicate relates x to y if the predicate already relates x. Sorry, the transitive version of the predicate relates x to z. first one is just saying, so here we say parent is the given predicate, the transitive version holds between x and z. If the given one holds between x and y, then the transitive version holds between y and z. Okay, so those are the clauses for transitive. And now we can use transitive versions of any predicate, or you could specifically define ancestor as the transitive version of parent. And now you can just, now there's a defining transitive closure once and for all. And we can even here have, so we can use that, so that will work exactly the same way as ancestor. And you can do really strange things here. You can actually do queries by saying, well, of what predicates are these two individuals in the transitive closure of? So you can use a query. You can do trans and then actually call predicate as a variable and then give x arguments for x and y and try and find out which predicates you have around for which this might work. Which you probably wouldn't want to do very often in the search could be pretty horrendous, but you can express it and the search does the right thing. Okay, so let's stop there today. So we're interested in looking at going from logic programming as looking at declarative reading of definite clauses and seeing how we can extend this. And we're extending it by introducing, instead of just normal first order terms, these abstract terms which allow the binding of variables. We're allowing variables not only of first order but of second and even higher order than that. We're allowing implication, universal quantification in our queries. And then we saw a way of dealing with the search, so we can deal with search for universal queries by sticking in a fresh constant. And we can deal with search for implications by dynamically, locally extending the clauses in the program. Okay, so that's everything today. So next week, the lectures will be in their normal places, and that will be the last week.